The content of this program is intended for people who are blind or print impaired. Hello, this is Greg Cockcroft from the North Carolina Reading Service, and this is The Atlantic. For the next half hour, I will be reading to you from The Atlantic magazine. Our first article today is entitled, A Private Company Wants to Block the Sun Responsibly. Written by Alexander C. Kaufman. The world's first major private geoengineering startup must have known it'd have skeptics. The basic premise, dimming the sun to artificially cool the planet, has been called reckless by scientists and climate advocates. Military analysts have said it has real security risks. Don't even get the conspiracy theorists started. Still, Stardust Solutions, an American-Israeli company planning to build a solar reflecting system in the next few years, has enough fans that it raised $60 million in 2025. Now it's trying to bring around the public and ease concerns over a technology for which its founders would prefer there wasn't any conceivable global need. For years, solar geoengineering research has focused on sulfate aerosols that effectively mimic the impact of volcanic eruptions. Because the cooling effects of volcanoes are well studied, the problems that could arise from spraying sulfur into the atmosphere are also well understood. They include damage to the Earth's ozone layer and acid rain. Stardust claims to have invented a unique particle that avoids these issues while matching the reflective powers of sulfur. This week Stardust is planning to release two documents that it hopes will help alleviate any fears over its next steps. The first is four pages of, quote, guiding principles, end quote, explaining why the company sees research into solar radiation modification, or SRM, as essential. The second document outlines a 14-page framework for safely deploying it outdoors. The documents are grand in their language and intricate in details, but neither document addresses two key questions facing this initiative. What kind of particle does Stardust want to inject into the atmosphere, and why should a private company be trusted to control a planet-altering technology? In its guiding principles, Stardust makes an argument for geoengineering that has quickly gained traction in the past couple of years among scientists and even environmentalists. Few advocate the use of geoengineering, right now at least, but as record heat waves turn deadly and polar ice melts threaten to set off uncontrollable natural cycles, a growing consensus is emerging that the technology needs to be at least studied. In that vein, the company stresses in a memo that Stardust is pursuing research and development, not deployment. Researching the technology now, it argues, is essential for any future informed decision-making by governments on whether, and if so, how, to deploy SRM. The principles also promise that Stardust will be cautious and committed to avoiding environmental harm as it begins to test its technology this year, and that it will release its data, methods, and results, including unfavorable ones, in a timely manner, following appropriate scientific validation. The framework in the second document focuses on testing. As a field, although admittedly a small one, geoengineering's testing strategy has hitherto erred on the side of asking for forgiveness, not permission. In 2012, for instance, a businessman conducted an experiment that allegedly violated United Nations rules and involved dumping iron sulfate off of Canada's west coast in a bid to speed up carbon absorption. 10 years later, a startup carried out a rogue experiment in Mexico, sending two weather balloons filled with sulfur dioxide and helium into the air. Stardust told me it has no outdoor tests planned and that it will not conduct any until relevant regulations are established. Its framework proposes extensive laboratory testing and computer modeling before beginning small-scale testing that they will tightly monitor, eventually scaling up to dispersing the particles across a wider area. Still, it's just a framework without any specifics on research plans. Holly Jean Buck, a University at Buffalo researcher whose book After Geoengineering spells out the potential benefits of this type of technology, told me. Frameworks are everywhere in academia, she said. Likewise, after I reviewed the details of the documents with her, she said that the guiding principles just seem like generic things that the research community has been talking about. The most obvious details missing from the documents are any information about Stardust's proprietary particle. None of us knows what they are hoping to put into the stratosphere for a profit, Cynthia Scharf, a senior fellow at the Brussels-based Center for Future Generations, who studies geoengineering, told me. Rather, she said, the new documents repeat Blythe Paean's to transparency, safety, and informed governance. Yanai Yedvad, Stardust CEO and a former nuclear scientist, told me that Stardust plans to unveil its particle in the coming months. Yedvad offered an alternative. Pharmaceutical companies, which are often funded by and work in partnership with governments, but which also work under strict regulation. You'd never believe a pharmaceutical company telling you that a cure for cancer is safe, he said. You have, for this, the regulators and independent bodies. But right now, at least in the U.S., no obvious agency would act as the Food and Drug Administration for geoengineering. And Stardust is already trying to shape whatever regulatory environment it might face. In its new guiding principles, too, Stardust forswears working with entities likely to engage in irresponsible activities with its technologies and argues that potential deployment should only take place through credible and informed international decision-making. Ultimately, the company envisions selling its services exclusively to national governments or international bodies, such as a United Nations agency. We expect and hope that governments will come together in a few years to allow international decision-making on SRM, much as they did with the Montreal Protocol, Yedvad told me, referring to a 1987 treaty to phase out of use the chemicals causing a hole in the Earth's ozone layer. As a business strategy, it's necessarily unusual. A global project to spray aerosols into the atmosphere could not have competition without unpredictable and potentially disastrous results. Who exactly might its customers be? Perhaps the U.S. and China together through some U.N. partnership, perhaps a middle power such as Brazil or India, could buy Starlink's intellectual property and engage the U.N. in some kind of global effort. Smaller countries already facing some of the worst effects of climate change, such as Ghana, recently started openly calling for access to their own geoengineering solutions. If governments don't buy into Stardust technology, the company's work could at the very least underscore how little progress governments themselves are making. Certainly, private industry is producing some of the most powerful breakthroughs of our age: reusable commercial rockets, deep ocean mining, chemistry that generates clean water from thin air, AI. Stardust could end up inventing a tool that wins over the public with transparent science and practices that prioritize public good. It could also be the West's best bet to maintain its lead over the technology that could offer humanity one of the most profound instruments to reshape the world, given that China has so far made only modest research efforts. Scientists and green groups have come around to the idea of researching these technologies more because of concerns over the failure of decarbonization efforts than a bullishness on geoengineering. Yedvad echoes the ideas of the emerging middle ground that geoengineering might buy the world time to build enough nuclear reactors, solar panels, and carbon capture projects to avoid reaching calamitous levels of heat. But he also told me that he sees geoengineering as a way to keep the standard of living we have now. This technology will allow people to live more or less the life they aspire to live, the life they're used to living, he said. We want to make sure our children will live in a world where they don't suffer the horrors of climate change. While this is not the only tool, and we should have the full portfolio, I think it's a unique tool that enables you to hold both sides at once. For how long? If the world's governments do use geoengineering to slow walk a transition from fossil fuels, as critics of the technology fear, the world could be locked into decades or even centuries of spraying the atmosphere to maintain the habitability of our planet. All the while, we could end up paying private companies for that privilege. But the cost of not having some kind of insurance policy against runaway warming could be even higher. Our second story is The Lost Idealism of Heartland Rock, written by Jack Hamilton. What was Heartland Rock? Did anyone ever really know? No less an authority than John Mellencamp dismissed the term as the work of, quote, lazy journalists, end quote. But in the 1980s, the music's heydays, the phrase denoted an array of artists and tendencies while also conjuring something more atmospheric. Everything about the sound was big. The guitars, the drums, the voices, the choruses tailor-made to be shouted along to at a stadium or at a wedding or in your car. Nowadays, probably to the embarrassment of your kids or grandkids. The bigness of the blaring synthesizer riff that opens Bruce Springsteen's 1984 smash Born in the USA and the soaring refrain of Tom Petty's 1989 classic Free Fallen and the pounding drums and crunching guitar that propel Mellencamp's own 1982 chestnut Hurts So Good. Heartland Rock had a big heart, too. It was concerned with the lives of everyday people, building worlds so vivid that listeners effortlessly recognized themselves in them. Heartland Rock's imagined community lies in both the quirky detail of chili dogs outside the Tasty Freeze in Mellencamp's Jack and Diane, and the more impressionistic evocations of a bygone backseat dalliances in Bob Seger's Against the Wind. The dominant mood was obsessive nostalgia. A remarkable amount of the music consists of grown men singing about teenagers. Tugging on the heartstrings can be a cheap trick in the hands of the wrong songwriter, but the genre's best songs are redeemed by a fastidious eye and poetic ear. In Springsteen's Born to Run, lovers, like fast cars, are sprung from cages on Highway 9, chrome-wheeled, fuel-injected, and stepping out over the line. Seeger in Night Moves evokes callow summer fumblings in language that's decidedly unromantic. I used her, she used me, but neither one cared. We were getting our share. Heartland Rock had a consistently left-leaning politics, although this aspect has long been a point of misunderstanding. Born in the USA expresses a Vietnam veteran's disillusionment with the country that sent him to war and then abandoned him. The title refrain is meant to be ironic. Just a few months after the song's release, the conservative columnist George Will chose not to hear it that way, describing the chorus as a grand, cheerful affirmation. Ronald Reagan praised the song's message of hope during a re-election campaign stop in New Jersey. Reagan's people reportedly also wanted to turn Mellencamp's Pink Houses into a theme song. Mellencamp intended that song to address racial and economic inequality. Its refrain, "Ain't That America," is at least partly sardonic. Mellencamp quashed the Reagan camp's effort, but decades later, such unauthorized use keep occurring. In 2022, Petty's estate wrote a cease and desist letter to Carrie Lake, who included his song "I Won't Back Down" in a video she posted on social media when she was refusing to concede the Arizona governor's race. Donald Trump, who rose to political prominence questioning the citizenship of Barack Obama, used Born in the USA at rallies during his 2016 presidential run. The chorus of a song filled with indelible images of American decline. down in the shadow of the penitentiary, out by the gas fires of the refinery. I'm 10 years burning down the road, nowhere to run, ain't got nowhere to go. Was pressed into service to score nativist points. In her new history, Won't Back Down, Heartland Rock, and The Fight for America, the music journalist Aaron Osman sets out to recover Heartland Rock's progressive potency and to illuminate how the musicians behind the genre dedicated themselves to improving the lot of ordinary Americans. Although most Heartland Rockers emerged in the 1970s and flourished in the 1980s, they were deeply influenced by the legacy of the 1960s, inheriting from those years a romantic belief in rock and roll as a force for psychic and social transformation. In the second half of the decade, rock festivals such as Woodstock and Monterey came to be seen as movement happenings as much as musical ones, and stars including Bob Dylan and the Beatles were cast as generational spokespeople, whether they liked it or not. When nearly 500,000 people descended on Bethel, New York in August of 1969, a lot of them earnestly believed that the music they listened to could be a key to a better future. Springsteen's Born to Run is a foundational Heartland Rock text from its spectacularly cinematic opener, Thunder Road, inviting us to go out riding tonight to case the promised land, to its 9.5-minute closing track, the New Jersey street epic Jungle Land. Seeger's multi-platinum Night Moves, buoyed by its hit title song, came out in 1976. Tom Petty and the Heartbreakers' breakthrough was 1979's Damn the Torpedoes, which included the future classics Refugee and Don't Do Me Like That. Mellencamp achieved megastardom in 1982 with American Fool and its singles Jack and Diane and Hurt So Good. Heartland rock tended to be more circumspect than the socially conscious pop of the previous decades. Certain Heartland rockers, Mellencamp especially, did take on issues of race, but little of the music's canon approaches the righteous indignation of the earlier anti-racist screeds, such as Neil Young's Southern Man and Alabama, and the music artists and audiences were overwhelmingly white. An old joke has it that Clarence Clemons, the late saxophone player for Springsteen's E Street Band, was the only black person who ever attended a Springsteen concert. Osman notes that critics called the music working-class rock before Heartland rock came into vogue. The terms are sometimes treated as interchangeable, but Heartland rock is in much wider use. Maybe that's because working class in these songs didn't really resemble the nation's actual working class. Heartland rock has a lot to say about white kids driving cars, but not much about black teenagers slinging burgers. And it wasn't always clear to the subjects of the songs were working class at all. The protagonist of Seeger's Against the Wind is pretty bummed out, but the song's line about his deadlines and commitments has always struck me as white collar. For an exemplary Heartland rock anthem, one could do worse than the song that Osman chose for her book's title, Petty's 1989 hit I Won't Back Down. Its opening verses are carefully understated, set to a cozy bed of keyboard pads and churning rhythm guitar, but once we hit the chorus, the recording explodes. There are soaring layers of harmony vocals, a glistening 12-string guitar part, driving drum fills that speed the song forward. And Petty's voice is direct and instantly unforgettable. Hey, baby, there's no easy way out, he belts. I will stand my ground and I won't back down. As a fist-pumping paean to resolve, it's tough to beat. But what is I Won't Back Down about? Damned if I know. The song is incredibly vague. The most detail that we get about the song's narrator is that he lives, quote, in a world that keeps pushing me around, end quote. We could be listening to a left-wing protester standing up to the cops, or a small government conservative raging against bureaucratic nanny state, or a teenager arguing with his parents. Or maybe he's simply a guy whose girlfriend is trying to break up with him, and he's fighting to save the relationship. And yet, the vagueness is part of what makes the song endure. Of course, Carrie Lake hears herself in I Won't Back Down, because everyone does. Most great songs aren't great because of what they're about. They're great because of how they make us feel. Heartland Rock had big sounds and sometimes big ideas, but what it really specialized in was big feelings. None of this diminishes the political commitments of the artists Osmond writes about, all of whom strove to live up to the ideals that their music gestured toward. The fight for America in the book's subtitle might mean sticking up for the fans, battling a record label to keep records inexpensive, as Petty did, and playing mid-sized markets so as to keep ticket and travel prices down, which Mellencamp insisted on. Springsteen became an advocate for veterans, Seeger for auto workers. Mellencamp simply refused all corporate sponsorships. Globe-spanning benefit concerts and blockbuster charity singles boomed in the 80s, and the Heartland Rock artists were fixtures at these affairs. In 1985 alone, Tom Petty and the Heartbreakers performed at Live Aid, Springsteen donated growly vocals to USA for Africa's We Are the World, and Mellencamp co-founded Farm Aid, an annual music festival that continues to this day and has raised more than $90 million. Sometimes the music does traffic in the kinds of clichés about middle American purity of spirit that have long been a hallmark of conservative rhetoric. Whatever the staunchly liberal Mellencamp intended to convey in songs such as Pink Houses and Small Town, the ambiguity of the writing makes them ripe for misuse. Osmond points out that Mellencamp's music has recently been covered by right-leaning country artists, including Trump supporters such as Jason Aldean and Luke Bryan. Still, the pinnacles of the Heartland Rock canon continue to thrill us in unexpected ways. Petty died in 2017, leaving behind a body of music so rich and distinctive that it overflows a genre history like Osmond's. His early work with the Heartbreakers had an affinity for the more cutting-edge sounds of punk and new wave. The term pop punk probably comes from the New York Times critic's John Rockwell's write-up of a Petty performance at the Bottom Line in 1977. In the 80s, Petty's music was certainly classified as Heartland Rock, but there was far more influence by the dreamy psychedelia of the Beatles and the Byrds than most other music in the genre. Through it all, he wrote incredible songs. His 1976 recording American Girl is undergoing a revival, thanks to a heart-racing needle drop at the end of Paul Thomas Anderson's One Battle After Another, where it breathes its 50-year-old energy into a new image of teenage exhilaration and political rebellion. The first time I saw Anderson's film in a theater and that chiming, buzzing guitar riff began pouring out of the speakers, I almost couldn't believe my ears. It was such an audacious choice, and a perfect one. Maybe American Girl is Heartland Rock. Maybe it's pop punk. Maybe it's just rock and roll. Or maybe it's all of those things and still defies categorization, as the best American music always has. Due to time constraints, I'm only going to be able to read a small portion of this next article. It's entitled Voting by Mail, written by Edward Stanwood for the October 1900 issue of The Atlantic. Almost all the evils of our political system, almost all the abuses of municipal, state, and national government are traceable to the neglect of civic duties by those whom, paradoxically, if this assertion is true, we term good citizens. The bad citizens are ever on the alert to storm the citadel or to fortify, entrench, and defend themselves when in possession. They have no scruples which forbid their use of stratagem and fraud to gain or retain power. Those who hold on to the maxim that the only object of government is good government must properly deny themselves the use of such means to dislodge the bosses, and such to enter politics merely to obtain livelihood at the public expense. It is permissible to them to win victories by the sheer force of numbers only. Inasmuch as their numerical superiority is not overwhelming in any of our large cities, it is extremely small in some of them, and it follows that the constant vigilance is required of them. And since they are aroused by to the full performance of their duty only occasionally and spasmodically, it also follows that many of our city and some of our state governments are usually in the possession of politicians whose aims are chiefly selfish. Nevertheless, it is obvious that the way to improvement of this existing system lies in the direction of rendering easier the performance of duty by the individual elector, rather than that of the lessening of the duty itself. It is the purpose of this article to suggest a change in the machinery of elections which could accomplish the desired result, and to give reasons why the probability of introducing new evils is by no means so great as it appears at first thought. The suggestion is that the requirement of the personal presence of the voter at the polls be abandoned, and that for the existing system to be substituted, one of voting by mail or by personal deposit of the ballot at the option of the elector. It will be admitted without argument that the compulsory presence of the voter at the polls works many hardships and is productive to injustice. There is no logical reason why a man who has the misfortune to break his leg or to contract an illness that confines him to his house should therefore lose his right to vote. Nor is there good cause for denying the suffrage. To one whose business imperatively calls him away from home on the day of election. It is not necessary to cite other similar cases, of which there are many, where voters are deprived of their privilege by a rule that everyone will admit should be abolished unless it is necessary to preserve the purity of elections. Attention may be called to the fact that, so far as the deprivation is a result of business preoccupation and not of physical disability, the rule takes away the rights of those who are presumably the persons best fitted to enjoy it. The requirement of actual presence at the polls, by reason of the inconvenience it occasions, is the chief explanation of the neglect of their political duties by many citizens. If the adoption of the mail ballot is desirable, if it would bring many people to the performance of their civic duties who now neglect them, and if only serious objection to it is that the form in which it is first presented increases the danger of corrupting the ballot, surely the wise statesman will not turn away from the reform as hopeless, but will seek a method of avoiding that danger. After all, the question regarding the reform under consideration resolves itself into this. Is the personal presence of electors at the polls a condition essential to the maintenance of the present degree of the purity of the ballot? If it is, there is an end to the discussion. If not, or if there be a doubt upon the subject, the invention of the necessary safeguards is worthy of the most careful thought and study. I'm sorry I had to edit that last article severely, but we've run out of time for today's episode of The Atlantic. Please join us next time. We hope you've enjoyed listening. I'm Greg Cockcroft, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind or print impaired. The Atlantic is available as a podcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org. If you have any comments or questions, please call 919-832-5138. Thank you for listening to the North Carolina Reading Service.